Welcome to Shifting Mindsets for Better Health, a podcast series produced by our partners at Central Michigan University with a grant from the Children's Foundation. COVID-19 has impacted the lives of millions. Sharing information among healthcare professionals is going to be key to saving lives and improving outcomes. This podcast series brings together healthcare professionals across disciplines to share insight into the far-reaching effects this pandemic has on children, caretakers, and medical care providers.
How can we prevent abusive trauma from happening?
The home environment has a lot to do with how much of a toll the pandemic has taken on each child.
This episode is the contribution of the COVID-19 pandemic to child abuse and mental health crises. The pandemic has taken a toll on families, resulting in trips to the hospital and emergency room for children from more than COVID infections. Dr. Usha Sitaraman is a pediatric emergency physician who works in the emergency department at Children's Hospital of Michigan and is a professor of pediatrics at CMU's College of Medicine. Dr. Sitaraman recounts her observations of child abuse during the pandemic.
You have to understand that the majority of the reporters are usually school social workers and teachers, right? That's where most of the reporting for suspected child abuse comes from. But because schools were closed and there were no teachers around and school social workers were not available, the reporting had gone down during the lockdown period. But that may not be necessarily true now that schools are up and running again. Major reporting still happened from emergency departments. And there are more and more studies coming out. In fact, I just heard another presentation at one of our American Academy of Pediatrics National Conference from another center where he also suggested that child abuse rates have gone up significantly during this past year and a half. Reporting is just one part of it, but the actual injuries that we're seeing and the rates of child abuse has also gone up. In our preliminary report, we did find that child abuse has nearly doubled in numbers, and also the types of fractures secondary to abuse has also increased. Firearm injuries were significantly higher during these 2 years compared to previous years. So in that sense, definitely there has been an increase in all of these rates. We're also looking right now into severity of injuries, not just for child abuse, but severity of injuries for children who are admitted to the hospital with these injuries, and also trying to correlate those with the social determinants of health. We're still not done with the study, but it's in the process right now. Our study that we did last year was just a retrospective study. There's no way for us to look at the causes of it. But our prospective study that we're doing right now is looking into the social determinants of health associated with severe injuries in children who are admitted to the hospital. And a small proportion of those are going to be abuse. So hopefully we'll have more data next year on that. But right now we're trying to look at the five parts of the social determinants, such as access to childcare, family income, living conditions, number of people who live at home, mental health is the fifth one. We're looking into all five of them. So far, although nothing to do with child abuse, we are finding so far in our preliminary findings, we saw that access to medical care, childcare, as well as higher rates of mental health services needs occurred in families with children who had severe injuries resulting in them being admitted. But that is not specifically related just to child abuse. That's overall for all, both accidental and non-accidental injuries. We've all been trained in identification of child abuse, but I think as healthcare providers, we should have a heightened awareness that it is happening at a higher rate in children during the pandemic. So we should have a heightened awareness to watch out for symptoms and signs. And as I previously stated, symptoms and signs of child abuse can very much resemble any other common illnesses of childhood. They could even present with fever and vomiting. But we just need to take a step back if it doesn't fit child abuse in the differential diagnosis. Any preambulating child, so that would be any child less than 9 months, 10 months, if you have a fracture, especially in a child less than 6 months old, you have a bony extremity fracture, you should consider child abuse in the differential diagnosis, right? Similarly, any child who has a subconjunctival bleed, who's really young infant, really there is no other cause for sudden appearance of bleed under the conjunctiva of the eye. And it's often missed because people give explanations and explain it away. But really, in a young infant who has a subconjunctival bleed, there should be a heightened awareness that this could be child abuse.
unexplained fever and vomiting with irritability and stuff like that, you should keep child abuse in your differential diagnosis. And also, I think it's really, really important for healthcare providers to look at the child completely, even if they are here for a year ache, you know, kind of strip them down, take a look, make sure there are no pattern bruising noticed on their body that may suggest abuse. I think that's important too, right? Because kids don't come out and say, hey, I was abused at home. Especially the ones who are less than 2 years are at the highest risk for missed diagnosis because they have no way of communicating it to us. So we should have a heightened awareness, lower the bar for investigation, and know that certain patterns are strongly associated with abuse. Like I mentioned, any fracture in a non-ambulating child, you got to consider child abuse. Any head injury in a non-ambulating child, any bruising on the face, you got to consider child abuse, especially in a young infant. And then presence of a subconjunctival bleed in a young infant for no reason is absolutely something that we should consider. So I think heightened awareness, especially during the pandemic, should be maintained by healthcare providers.
Children's Hospital of Michigan implemented triggers in their system to help alert healthcare staff that child abuse should be considered. Dr. Sadaraman explains the system and makes some suggestions for child abuse prevention.
Bottom line is anybody can report suspected child abuse. It does not have to be a healthcare provider. It could be a neighbor. It could be a teacher. It could be any concerned person, right? But as far as the ED goes, if we do recognize or if we are suspecting, we have a couple of triggers actually in our ER. That was part of one of my past studies that we incorporated into our electronic medical record system, wherein if we have a constellation of symptoms and signs, we may get an EMR alert saying, hey, are you considering child abuse? And then if I click, yes, I am, then it'll take me automatically to the AAP's recommendation as part of our power plan for orders. So it's not only important to recognize and consider child abuse, it's also equally important to do a complete workup and not miss out. So a child who's less than 6 months old, whom you're considering child abuse, we should be getting a CAT scan of the head. That's part of our AAP's guidelines. So it automatically takes you to all those orders so they can click off on those and make it a complete investigation. Also, we have another step in triage or in the room where the nurses fill out a form that has 6 questions on it, which is basic stuff like, do you suspect neglect? Have you undressed the child and look for any bruising? Do you think the child looks dirty to you? Are you concerned for child abuse? So that's another alert for us. If they fill out a positive yes for any of those 6 questions, then the healthcare provider is alerted that there is a possibility for child abuse. So those are our steps where we've tried to come together as an ED team. It is not foolproof by any stretch of imagination because our EMR does not recognize words. It only recognizes pre-checked forms. So if I had a yes or no and I clicked off a yes, then it recognized that and triggers an alert. But if I wrote it down in words that I'm suspecting child abuse in any part of the chart, that is not going to be recognized by our EMR. So it's definitely not foolproof. But it's certainly an additional step. And then for any orders that were placed in a child, let's say we saw a kid that's 5 months old in whom for some reason I have ordered an x-ray of the forearm, then that's going to be an automatic trigger for me. Hey, are you considering abuse? Because you're ordering an x-ray of an extremity in a child who's too young to have a fracture. Or if I consulted, for example, a neurosurgeon in a young infant less than 2 years, that's going to be an alert for me. So we've created these alerts based on both exam as well as based on nursing forms and on specific orders that we have placed to help us remember child abuse as a differential diagnosis. But ultimately, it is up to the providers to have a heightened sense of awareness. And it's tricky because, you know, when you're seeing 200, 300 patients a day, many of them presenting with vomiting is a constant symptom in the ED, especially during the flu season, right? But to be able to pick out that one child with vomiting who turned out to be vomiting from abusive trauma to the abdomen or to the head versus the million other kids who presented with vomiting due to the stomach virus is tough. And we're trying our best to give them additional support. But I think ultimately we have to have a heightened awareness. Social workers do have ample resources to direct the parent to. But the first concern would be to remove the child from an abusive environment. And that doesn't mean that they have to go to a complete stranger's house as a foster parent. Most of the time, the foster relocation is usually a grandparent or an aunt who's not part of that household. So that's our first concern. We need to do more as a society. I think the best example is what happened with trauma care overall in this country, right? In the 1980s, there was a very high mortality from road accidents. So what did we do? We divided them into three things. We said we will do a pre-injury phase, we will do a during injury phase changes, and then post-injury phase care. The pre-injury phase was basically getting in car seats, getting in seat belts mandated, keeping your car speeds down, getting ticketed for speeds that are high, putting in airbags, putting in side airbags. These were preventative model as part of the pre-care. And then during care, we decided we will scoop and run. We won't treat at the scene of the accident, but we'd rather scoop and take them to the nearest trauma center. And then we organized our trauma care for those patients. Teams were created. We actually had a life support course for trauma that is consistent across the entire country now. They had specific guidelines on how to take care of a injured child or adult. And then the post-care, what happens? Do they go to the operating room? Do they go over? So I think the same model needs to be applied to child abuse. We are doing quite a bit for identified child abuse. After the injury has happened, I think we are trying more and more to recognize it, get the kid out of the environment, treat specific abusive injuries. And we're certainly doing some post-intervention, but we still have to continue to work on the pre-phase. How can we prevent abusive trauma from happening? I mean, our studies have shown that these families are highly stressed out during the COVID pandemic. And we have identified three or four factors that are at greatest need for these families, such as childcare, mental health needs. And I think as a community, we need to work on implementing the pre-injury interventions and kind of be prepared not only to help out during this pandemic, but be prepared for any future pandemics, God hoping we won't have, but it's a possibility always.
Some children are facing extreme mental health challenges and crises during the pandemic. Dr. Nikita Roy is the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Fellowship Director and an Assistant Professor of Psychiatry in the CMU College of Medicine. Dr. Roy explains her experiences in the hospital psychiatric unit, but also how children's mental health issues are going unnoticed during the pandemic.
One of the issues that has cropped up in my line of work pretty frequently is that with the shift to online school and with a lot more time being spent in the home, some of the folks out in the community who would recognize that people are struggling aren't there to recognize those signs anymore. So that might include teachers, it might include coaches, might include instructors of other kinds. Those extra eyes that kids often have when they're out in the world are reduced. So I'm encouraging folks to just keep a little bit more of a close eye, try to pick up on things, ask those extra questions that maybe a teacher would have asked that now they're not getting the opportunity to really do that if they're online. And just make sure not to gloss over things and assume that somebody else would be. Because I think generally right now people's supports are still pretty small. And so if you're a provider or you're an external person seeing this kid for whatever reason, just have a more broader approach to how you're seeing them. Some emotional and mental health issues that children and families are facing through the pandemic. It's a broad question and it's a broad answer as well. I work primarily in the hospital setting, the psychiatric inpatient unit, which is a higher acuity center. So I'm seeing kids who typically are in the midst of a crisis compared to my counterparts who work on the outpatient side, seeing outpatient psychiatric patients, in which case the severity may not be as intense as what is seen on the hospital side. And the variety in disorders might also be a little bit different than the inpatient side. But to speak more broadly, prior to the pandemic, there's been a rising rate of mental health conditions in the child and adolescent population. The pandemic has put a strain on that, for sure. There's literature out there. It's a little bit spotty. There's some inconsistency, but I think as a whole, and what I have personally noticed in the hospital, is that there's definitely an increase. There's an increase in kids who are feeling depressed. There is a significant increase in kids who are feeling really anxious. We're seeing more issues with behavioral problems at home and reintegrating back to school. We're seeing ADHD that seems to go untreated or missed. And we're seeing rates of suicidality increase as well. Another issue that stems more kind of from a family unit, but issues that are cropping up tend to be kids being at home all day with parents who have their own mental health issues. And that's having subsequent effects on the child and leading to some either family dynamic issues or leading to the development of mental health issues in that particular child. The home environment has a lot to do with how much of a toll the pandemic has taken on each child. There's no guarantee. We've certainly seen families that are high functioning, that are supportive, that are engaged and there for their kids who are still suffering. But I would say that is a much smaller percentage of folks than those coming from homes that tend to be fairly chaotic. As far as things returning sort of back to normal now that things are settling down with the pandemic, I haven't seen that shift correlate to the severity of illness in the hospital. I think there's still a lot of sequelae as a result of the pandemic. I want to be hopeful and say that I think it is getting better, but I think the pandemic has also sort of revealed a larger issue with how kids are managing themselves when they don't have a lot of time, and that includes social media, drugs, how they manage relationships. And so I think we're seeing all of that come to light in a different way now that the pandemic is getting better. And then there's also kind of a diverging group of kids that are struggling with school in person, but then also struggling in school virtually. And seeing those two different paths has been pretty interesting too. Prior to the pandemic, frequently I would hear kids ask me, can you tell my parents that I need to be in school online? I don't like going to school in person, or I get bullied a lot and I want to be doing school online. And most of the time my answer is I actually don't recommend that. But since the pandemic forced people to go virtual, a lot of the folks that I saw in the hospital were saying, get me back to school in person. I can't be online. My grades aren't as good. I miss my friends. And it was just sort of this flip from get me online to get me back in school. And I think there's always going to be kids on both ends of the spectrum. And it's just figuring out where they fall in terms of how the pandemic has affected them. My personal thought is that virtual socialization is better than none. Throughout the initial parts of the pandemic, there was a lot of emphasis on staying connected to people, and that was all through virtual means, given the needs for social distancing and stay-at-home orders and all of that. And it isn't perfect, but I think for kids who are fairly tech savvy, it's an easy thing for them to do these days. It's a way that a lot of them are connecting to begin with, so it's nothing new for them. And I think it fills a little bit of that gap. It just doesn't fill it entirely, but better than nothing.
The pandemic has not changed the treatment options available to mental health care providers, but the pandemic has affected the modes of treatment delivery. Dr. Roy explains the effects of the pandemic on treatment, resilience, and awareness for children's mental health.
Therapy is usually the number one kind of go-to recommendation, depending on the severity of symptoms that we're seeing. If they're in the hospital, they're with me, it usually means things have reached ahead and things are pretty bad. And at that point, we're thinking about combination treatment, which is going to include medications along with therapy. But first line typically is going to get them connected to a therapist. And a lot of therapists nowadays are virtual, so they can do that from home, or some of them have the option of going back in person, similar to how schools are addressing the situation. That is always going to be first line. For kids, having an outlet, having a space where they can talk about how they're feeling in a non-judgmental, very open space is going to be essential for them. So that's always recommendation number one. And then, like I said, earlier, medications are going to be your next option depending on the severity of symptoms and depending on what the primary diagnosis is. You may or may not need to involve other people in the treatment plan for an individual depending on what their diagnosis is. For example, if their depression has ramped up as a result of being home all the time and they have a lot of conflict with their parents, you might be recommending that they're doing not just individual therapy, but they also are doing family therapy. So there's definitely a lot of individualization that happens per case, but I can say across the board, all these kids who are presenting to a mental health facility or to a pediatrician or family doc are going to be diverted first to a therapist. So that is definitely the best first step. When it comes to resilience in kids and how the pandemic may or may not be testing that, I think that's a pretty hard question. I think there's sort of a innate amount of resiliency that every kid comes into this world with. And some kids have the ability to make that grow, whereas for some kids that seems to shrink. I think a lot of that is related to the level of support, the level of encouragement, and the environment in which they grow up, and sort of the power that they are given to make choices and grow themselves. And so I think the pandemic has really made kids' bubbles pretty small. For the most part, that's going to be their home setting and maybe some friends and neighbors if they had them close by and parents were okay with them interacting at the height of the pandemic. But for a lot of folks, that bubble is their home. And if that home isn't a safe place, you tend to see their resiliency kind of fizzle out compared to a kid who's living in a really supportive home. You'll tend to see that flourish. I think every kid is resilient in their own way, but the amount and sort of the energy they have to put that towards their own mental health has a lot to do with their external surrounding. I hope that the new normal doesn't look much different than the pre-pandemic normal. I hope that kids can be getting back to school. Kids are able to socialize, get involved in activities, and whether that's clubs or sports or music or art, getting involved and staying involved. That need for social interaction is so, so important. And I think there were necessary steps that had to be taken during the pandemic with the stay-at-home orders and school closures. But my hope is that with the vaccine and with more awareness about the pandemic, and hopefully with the rates slowing, that we can keep kids socially engaged, because that is very, very important for them, whether you're 5 or 6 years old or whether you're 16 or 17 year old. That need for social interactions is essential. And you need to grow that bubble outside of just your family. The younger you are, the more acceptable I think it would be to spend a lot more time at home. But the older that you get, you need to start branching out. You need to start testing the waters, sort of learn and make mistakes along the way. And if you're stuck at home, it's impossible to do that. So my hope is that things will look similar to like they did prior to the pandemic. I think there will be some avenues that are beneficial for people that have a hard time with certain mental health conditions to balance being online and in person. I think having that hybrid model will go a really long way for some folks. So as far as schooling goes, I think the use of telemedicine and virtual education is going to open up a lot of doors. I also think there's a lot of initiative, there's a lot of funding, there's a lot of government support to increase care for mental health conditions in the child and adolescent population. And that has expanded a lot during the pandemic. Because like I said, I think a lot of disorders have become revealed over this last year and a half. And people broadly, including folks in the government, have been able to recognize that. So I'm hoping that we're going to have more resources, we're going to have more access with telemedicine, we're going to have more opportunities for different styles of learning in the school system, and we're going to have more access to social activities. I'm hopeful I don't think it's going to be gone anytime soon, but I'm hopeful that we can return to a pretty similar baseline to where we were before we started.
Thank you to Drs. Usha Sethuraman and Nikita Roy for sharing their expertise on the contribution of the COVID-19 pandemic on child abuse and mental health crises. To find out about our other podcasts, go to med.cmich.edu/shiftingmindsets. The Shifting Mindsets for Better Health podcast series is a production of the College of the Arts and Media, the College of Medicine, and the Interdisciplinary Center for Community Health and Wellness at Central Michigan University. Executive producer and host is Dr. Heather Polinsky. Interview recording and editing by Mr. Michael Potter. Produced by Drs. Judy Blabia, Allison Arnold, and John Lowry. Funded by a grant from the Children's Foundation.